everyone, thanks for joining us for another episode of Lid Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Francesca. And for this episode, we have a very special guest with us, Peter Walker. So welcome, Peter.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's lovely having you. Peter Walker is a senior partner emeritus at McKinsey & Co., the world's leading management consultancy firm. And during his 46 years at the firm, he worked with a wide range of financial institutions around the world with a focus on China. So Peter is the author of Powerful, Different and Equal. It's a timely analysis exploring the core misconceptions between the two dominant forces in today's world, the US and China. So it includes governance, economic, social, military issues and the root causes of these misconceptions between the two powers. So Peter, your book starts talking about the different governance models in the US and China. So what would you say the main differences are between these two models? And do you think there's anything that these models have in common?
Yeah, well, the models really could not be more different the way they are constructed. The U.S. model really goes back to the fact that the colonists who escaped Europe to come to the U.S. Were really leaving behind a class-driven economic system, which meant there was very little economic opportunity for people who were not born into the upper classes. And then they were also escaping the lack of personal freedom, religious freedom. So when the Founding Fathers set up the Constitution in the late 1700s, they really were starting with a mindset of how to create a minimalist government. In other words, a government that would not interfere either in individuals' ability to pursue economic opportunity and would not get in the way of them being able to exercise personal freedom.
Sure.
So the mindset was minimalist, and they accomplished this in a couple of different ways. One was it was set up from the beginning as an electoral system, which means all of the senior positions were going to be voted in by the people, and two opposing parties who, you know, by definition, were polar opposites in terms of their points of view, in terms of how they wanted the government run. So it kind of almost started out with the idea that the government was going to struggle to reach agreement because the parties were taking different points of view. The second minimalist factor was that we had three co-equal branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, which by and large had to come together if you're going to be able to affect major change.
Yeah.
And then the final minimalist feature were open elections for the presidency every 4 years, so if people were unhappy, they could change the government out. So when you think about how that government was designed, implicitly what the Founding Fathers were saying was we want our country defined by our economy, not by our government. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the U.S. model, the best and the brightest have always gone into business as opposed to going into government.
Yes.
And if you look at the results, you know, we've had maximum personal freedoms, and we've had the world's strongest economy over the last 150 years. So very much grounded in the mindsets the colonists had when they left Europe. If you look at China, you know, you have a totally different history. So the history is, unlike the U.S., which has never had enemies at its border, China, you know, existed for thousands of years with the Mongolians, the Manchurians, and other nomadic tribes to their north who were constantly invading China. So China learned at a relatively young age that it had to pull people together in a way that would enable them to defend themselves effectively.
Yeah.
So the notion of a strong central government was paramount in China going back thousands of years. And that government is actually run not unlike a major corporation. So you have a president who is the executive in charge. Instead of a board of directors, you have the standing committee of the Politburo, which today consists of 7 people who provide oversight and direction and basically provide counsel to the president. People rise up in that government not through elections but through meritocracy. So if you go back 1,000 years, there were annual examinations given that were open to everybody, and whoever got the best scores were going to the best colleges and had preferential treatment for going into government. And even today, you have the organization committee of the party that basically does a very thorough annual review of the top, pick a number, 5,000 members of the party, and basically reviews them, promotes them when they have performed at a high level, and makes sure they have a breadth of experience. So you have a very different model in China in the sense that the scope of the government is really unlimited. So under the Chinese Communist Party, anything that the government believes is fundamental to the well-being of the country and its people is fair game for the government to basically decide how it's going to be managed. So two very different models in design, and also importantly in terms of where the talent went. And it's pretty hard to argue that they both haven't been quite successful.
Definitely. I think it's really interesting what you're saying about the educated in China go into the government, but in the US, they go into business. So actually, that's quite an interesting difference. And also the power that a border can have, obviously, the US kind of being an island on its own. Again, it's a really interesting point you make.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
I mean, also talking about their economic models in a bit more detail, you've mentioned the US already on that front, but so the bottom-up free enterprise capitalism in the US versus kind of the top-down government-directed control in China, both models are historically highly successful and resilient. I mean, do you think this success is due to similarities, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the models have actually been gradually converging over time. So if you look at the U.S., virtually all of the economic engine of the U.S. is private enterprise, capitalistic driven. The government's role has increased vis-a-vis business over the years.
Okay.
So there's an increasing amount of regulation, largely focused on ensuring financial stability and integrity. There's regulation around safety as it affects consumers and fair marketing practices. But essentially, it is a bottoms-up driven model. Driven under a free enterprise system. China is not totally different in the sense that 70% of the economy, and certainly a much higher percentage of the economic growth, is really driven by private enterprises in China. There are state-owned enterprises, but their return on capital is probably half that of the private sector.
Right.
And you have many very successful private companies in China, like Alibaba, like Tencent, like Baidu, and a number of others. So the real fundamental difference is that while the U.S. can intervene as a government by exception in terms of things like regulation or antitrust, that in China, the government really is in control of the economy. They're not directly in control in the sense that they tell each company, whether a private enterprise company or whether it's a state-owned enterprise, exactly what they ought to be doing. But they definitely will subsidize certain industries that they want to grow. They will ensure that there's cooperation between critical universities and governments in key areas of technology. And in fact, they make the key personnel decisions in all of the state-owned enterprises. If you look at what the engines of the economy have been, certainly over the last 40 years, it's largely been technology-driven. The U.S. has taken the lead in technology and has always been the predominant player globally in terms of what I would call breakthrough inventions that have really had transforming effects on the economy. Okay. So whether it was the mass production of automobiles or the invention of the telephone and telegraph or making electricity broadly available across the country, or more recently, the technology of the iPhone, of search engines like Google, of Facebook and social media. Yeah. But technology has been the driver, and I think the U.S. has absolutely been in the forefront. In China, you know, if you realize that their industrial revolution didn't start until little more than 100 years after the U.S. did, because they were consumed by internal conflict, a civil war, and then a lot of disruption in the early period of Mao's reign, where you had the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. So it really wasn't until 1978, Deng, you know, quickly realized that China was far behind the rest of the world, largely because of the lack of technology. And fortunately for China, and maybe some would say not so fortunately for the West, you know, he led a brilliant effort to basically co-opt that technology and adapt it and learn from it and apply it broadly in China, which enabled China to become the low-cost manufacturer globally, because they had access to a lot of the best technology developed elsewhere, and they also had the advantage of low-cost labor. If you look at the economies, I think they're really about to enter the first period of direct major head-to-head competition. Because if you look at what's driven the global economy, originally it was agriculture, then it was far more productive agriculture, and then it was manufacturing. And now we're moving to a period where manufacturing is gradually declining globally, as technology plays a bigger role in providing the goods and services that people are looking for. And China has already declared that their goal, and they call the program 2025, where they want to be at or among the world leading positions for each of 10 critical technologies going forward. And those 10 technologies today are pretty dominated by the U.S. So I think going forward, we're going to see the first real competition, direct competition head-to-head between the U.S. and China. That'll be very interesting to see how it plays out.
Definitely. So there's a sense that they're sort of catching up now, and there's the real race is starting.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah. And, you know, the U.S. has had a big advantage, A, because they had a 100-year head start. The U.S. also has far and away the best university system in the world, and therefore a lot of the scientific breakthroughs take place at some combination of our top universities and labs, as well as the major corporations. And China, in some of these fields, has already made great progress, so they're already the world leader in areas like renewable energy. But there are other areas like chip manufacturing and biotech where they're still pretty far behind the U.S. But, you know, one of the key differences between the U.S. and China is China grows 8 times as many scientists, engineers, mathematicians, and technologists as the U.S. does. So 8 times, 8-to-1 ratio. So while the U.S. has a better university system, China has a real advantage in terms of real manpower. So I think going forward, people like to talk about who's going to win. To me, that's not a relevant question. These are going to be the two dominant countries in the global economy. They're both going to be very technology-driven, and they're each going to be, you know, catching up and passing the other in a fairly iterative way over time.
Well, yeah, it'll be interesting to keep an eye on it, which I'm sure you will. I mean, another really interesting point in your book, I mean, we've said in the introduction, it covers quite a few areas from both China and the US, but it's the human rights side. So There are a lot of developments in both countries, and human rights in China sort of lag quite far behind the US as of 2019. I mean, based on your analysis in the book, why do you think this is?
Well, it really goes back to history. So if you go back to what I said about the U.S., you know, if you think about the colonists who were writing the U.S. Constitution, having come out of Europe, they started with the idea that human and religious rights were going to be, you know, at the very top of the priority list. And you'd certainly have to say the U.S. has been far from perfect in implementing that, especially with respect to minorities. You would also say it's taken a long time for the U.S. to actually deliver on that promise with respect to women, and many would say they still have a ways to go there. But there was never a question about the intent that providing those rights was going to be at the very top of the list. China, having had a much more difficult and challenging history, marked by, you know, invasions from the West in the Opium Wars in the 19th century, then you had a period of time where they were ruled by warlords, then you had the civil war between the nationalists and the communists, and then you had the challenges in the early, you know, the first 20 years of Mao's reign. So the Chinese people never had the luxury of the natural resources that the U.S. had, or the safety of not having to worry about, you know, people, enemies at their border. So the Chinese are very pragmatic, and so their point of view was always first comes food and being able to sustain yourself, then housing, then safety, then health. And so they've always treated human rights as important, but something that was going to be in a hierarchy of other more basic needs that people had. And then the other fundamental difference is the U.S., going back to its Judeo-Christian roots, has always had a primacy view of an individual. You know, think about it as a child of God, and therefore every individual life is precious.
Yeah.
China has always grown up as a collectivist society. So when you talk to people about human rights in China, they are far more interested in the fact that the country has raised 800 million people out of poverty. Or the fact that they've developed wonderful infrastructure to enable people to improve the quality of their life. So when you talk to the Chinese about dissidents, they really are not interested. In other words, they feel that if you've got 150 or 200 people who are protesting against the government, A, it's their only government.
Yeah.
The people are very supportive of the Chinese government because it's raised their standard of living dramatically, and they have no sympathy whatsoever for dissidents who are trying to disrupt the government. So the real core difference in the two countries is this collectivist view on the one hand versus individualistic on the other. Now, that being said, China has actually made great progress in human rights. So if you go back to the late 1970s, they had what was called the Hukou system, where every person in China was told what village you will live in, what apartment you will live in, what job you would have, how much you would get paid, and if you wanted to travel to another village, you have to have government approval, and if you wanted to marry, you needed government approval. And that system has been largely dismantled, except with respect to property ownership. So if you don't have a hukou from Shanghai, you can't buy property in Shanghai. And then also importantly for migrants. So migrants who have left the rural areas to go into the big cities, you know, still don't have access to all public services in terms of education, healthcare, and housing. The government is aware of that problem, and what they're saying today is we're going to gradually build up our capabilities in that area, but at this point in time, we can't afford it. But the mindset, going back to individualistic versus collectivist, is very fundamental, and that's why in the West, you'll see constantly in the media a reference to dissidents who were not treated fairly. Obviously, you'll see what's going on in Hong Kong, where people are crying out for a return to the democracy that they grew up with. You see the issue of the internment of the Uyghurs, which everybody in the West, you know, thinks is a terrible thing to do, and frankly, I'm sure some Chinese do too. But the Chinese are so focused on stability on behalf of the entire population, that their feeling is that if they have to take tough action with 1 million out of 1 billion for people to ensure stability, they're willing to do it, even though from the West it creates a huge barrier between us and China.
I mean, just hearing you speak and sort of after reading the book, we've established how many sort of differences there are, but actually sort of towards the beginning there are a lot of similarities. And just looking more to the future, we've heard a lot of in the news about sort of China and the US, and there's been trade deals going on, but how do you think the relationship's going to be in the future? How will it develop?
Well, you know, an awful lot of attention gets focused on the military competition, which from my point of view is totally misguided. You know, the reality is, if you go back to the values that have shaped the West, the U.S. and Western Europe have always been what I would call a dualistic society. And a lot of it is rooted in the religious history. So you'll always be hearing good versus evil,
yeah,
heaven versus hell, winners versus losers. So it's a mindset that lends itself to more of a zero-sum game, which is how we see President Trump obviously thinks about it when he talks about the trade war.
Yeah.
Those values, the values in the East, have always been harmony and balance. So if you look at China's military record, over the last 1,000 years, they have been involved in 3 relatively minor invasions, 2 in Vietnam, 1 in Korea. None of them would have lasted more than a year. None of them had any lasting impact. And if you look at China today, their defense budget is 1/3 of the U.S., even though they have 4 times as many people.
Sure.
And they just pragmatically view spending money on military beyond what you need to defend yourself as a diversion of funds that could be much better spent raising the standard of living, improving health care, improving education, and infrastructure. So I think going forward, the real battle between the U.S. and China is going to be very heavily concentrated in the economic space.
Okay.
And we're seeing that in the trade war. And, you know, I think the real question is the decoupling that Trump has started with the trade war, and in many ways is encouraging when he literally says the U.S. doesn't need China, would be a lose-lose for both sides. I mean, if you look at the trade war to date, both countries are being hurt in terms of economic growth. Both countries are being hurt in terms of productivity, because the advantage of an open free trade system is every country does what it does best, and everyone in the world gets to enjoy the fruits of everyone else's labor. I personally feel that that the current model that Trump is pursuing of decoupling is not going to be sustained in future administrations, because it does hurt each side in terms of economic growth, and it also hurts the development of sciences that are so critical to technology, because if you look at all the breakthrough scientific advances over the years, they have been generally multinational efforts with open architecture and complete sharing of discoveries among the scientific community across geographic borders. And to the extent that the U.S. raises barriers to doing that, which they have been doing recently, then we're going to see a slowdown in economic progress. But ultimately, the hope, and this is what I point out in the book, is that each side will settle into what they do best.
Yeah.
There will be competition, certainly in areas like trade, but that there will be room for cooperation and constructive engagement on issues where both countries are on the same side. So certainly the environment is a great example. Dealing with the refugee issue is another great issue. Another one commonly shared is protecting space and making sure it does not become militarized. But right now, the tensions between the U.S. and China are just too high, and Trump's go-it-alone approach for the U.S. and his America First model are clearly leading to a short-term decoupling. Like I said, I don't expect that to be sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we're all going to have to keep an eye on to see the developments. I mean, we've covered so many topics in this, and it's quite a nice sort of dip into different areas of your book. And I really urge everyone to sort of get a copy of Powerful, Different and Equal, because, yeah, there's so much more detail in the book, and I feel like, yeah, it's a topic that's going to affect us all in the future, so we need to sort of wise up on it. It was incredibly interesting to read. So, yeah, lastly, just for anyone that's interested in taking another look at your book, I mean, apart from buying it, where can they find you? Do you have a website that we could look at, or your LinkedIn?
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, at this point in time, the best way to connect is through the book itself. I am in the process of developing what I think will be a pretty professional website.
Great.
And that's due to be up in the first week of December. And it'll be peterbwalker.com. It'll provide a pretty good roadmap for how to stay in touch, both in terms of a blog that I'll be doing as well as the book, as well as enabling people to see where I will be speaking and taking other initiatives in the marketplace.
Sure, fantastic. Well, we look forward to having a look. Well, thank you so much, Peter, for joining us today. It's been incredibly interesting. And I just want to thank also everyone for listening. So don't forget to keep an eye on our social media, so at Lid Publishing on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, for more information about new books, experts' opinions and more podcasts like this. So thank you, and I'll see you again on Lid Radio Podcast.